This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of July 7th, 2005.
All right, please, police!
Bad Cop No Donut.
Bad, 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 bad.
Cop, 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 cop.
No, 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 no.
Donut, 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 donut.
It's under law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. We use the majority of our time on this program reviewing the North American press as it pertains to police abuse. This week, we'll take a closer look at two stories, one in Los Angeles and one here in Toronto, which so far have been completely ignored by the mainstream media. In Los Angeles, an LAPD officer named Scott Druyan has been found guilty on a number of internal charges connected to an incident of sexual misconduct. Details of the precise charges against Druyan have not been made available by the LAPD, but they do confirm that a recent hearing recommended the termination of his employment with the department. In January of this year, Druyan was accused of beating his wife. An investigation of the domestic abuse incident was handled by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and the LA County District Attorney's Office declined to charge the officer in March. Druyan's wife, Michelle, will be joining us in a few minutes to tell us her side of the story. On June 26th, Bill Blair became the first Toronto police chief to march in Toronto's annual Gay Pride Parade. Around 12 hours earlier, officers from 51 Division entered a well-known bar in the Gay Village and ordered it closed due to overcrowding. They are accused of then beating the club's owner, Amir Ebrahimia, for 15 minutes, terrorizing his elderly parents and doing significant damage to the establishment. Later in this program, you'll hear Ebrahimia tell you what happened in his own words. We'll also learn about the police version of events and the mainstream television report about the allegations that was never broadcast. Next week, we'll return with our usual review of the news.
Officer Druyan went to a Board of Rights, and it was recommended that he be terminated. So that's under review still by the Chief of Police. And then Officer Villalobos is pending his Board of Rights still, and he is currently relieved from duty assigned to home. It was some sort of, from what I understand, some sort of sexual misconduct charges, that's all. And that's all I can do is tell you the nature of the allegation.
Okay.
I can't tell you exactly what the allegation was.
Do you know a timetable for the chief's decision on the termination?
You know, it just depends. I mean, there's, you know, he has scheduled signings every month, so no, I don't know. I don't even know what phase that is in yet, if it's been prepared for his review yet.
We're talking about months rather than
days.
Yes,
but it was a recommended termination by the Board of Rights.
Yes.
I could tell you that we assigned this case in January. The case was presented to the District Attorney's Office, and they rejected the case, and that's all I have.
Okay, this case was declined from our office.
First, we turn to Los Angeles, California, where the wife of an LAPD officer says she provided the information which ultimately led to her husband being brought up on internal charges. Scott Druyan had been on the streets of L.A. for less than a year when his wife, Michelle, discovered that he and his partner, Robert Villalobos, had been carrying on an affair with two female employees of a men's establishment in the district where the pair worked while they were on duty. A spokesperson for the LAPD confirmed that Druyan and his partner were found guilty at internal hearings on charges relating to allegations of sexual misconduct. The hearing concluded by recommending Druyan's termination from the force. This was not the end of the story for Michelle Druyan. In January of this year, after several attempted reconciliations, she says that she was badly beaten by her husband. A spokesperson for the LA County Sheriff's Department confirmed that an investigation of the incident was assigned to a detective shortly after it was reported. On March 9th, the LA County District Attorney's Office declined to charge Officer Druyan in connection with the incident. So far, there has not been a word in the media about Scott Druyan, and despite the established charges and other serious allegations against him, he remains an employee of the LAPD for the foreseeable future. It is likely that a decision on whether or not to terminate the officer will not be made by the chief for several months. I spoke with Scott Druyan's wife, Michelle, last week.
I knew something was wrong when our computer got a virus, and being one to want to try and fix it myself, I was trying to get rid of a virus and started coming across lots and lots and lots of pornography on my computer that I wasn't aware of at all, and a letter that to a stripper that indicated they had some kind of a relationship going on. And I was completely not told the truth. In fact, he denied even looking at the pornography at that time, which it was the only computer in the house, and we were the only two people there. So that was actually 2 years ago this month. It was in the beginning of July of 2003.
So you haven't had any trouble with your husband up until this point?
Well, we had some difficulties with our relationship, and it was in a sexual nature, but nothing that I thought there was a medical problem, actually, which was what I was told and led to believe, and I thought it was a medical reason that we were not having the relationship I was hoping to be having, and that I believed that. I trusted him.
I'm guessing you confront him.
Yes, most definitely. I start realizing, I mean, there was so much of it, and the computer was really new. So I started figuring that it had what the relationship problems were a lot less to do with medical reasons and a lot more to do with other things. And so most definitely I confronted him. He lied. Then I found a piece of paper. I even called Microsoft and Hewlett Packard and asked if there was any way this stuff could get on my computer without one of the two of us doing it, because he was so convincing that he had not been looking at this stuff. And then I found a piece of paper with a bunch of websites written on it that was in his writing. He said that he must have had that from before we were together, but he had written it on a little notepad that I had myself gotten just a few months before, and we had been together for years at this point, so I knew that wasn't true either. It was the next lie. And I just got a barrage of lies after that about everything. So that's why it's been 2 years now. It took me about a full year to find out exactly what was going on by becoming a detective myself. One of the detectives in the Internal Affairs Department of the LAPD said I could match any one of their detectives anytime when I did, in fact, turn over all the evidence I had.
What did you end up taking them in the end?
Just proof that he, in fact, was receiving oral sex on duty, while on duty, was frequenting the nude strip bar that was within his division, him and a partner, using their badges and uniforms to get in for free, and were actually customers during their duty. They each met one of these strippers and started affairs, and it would protect each other and cover for each other, and it was all going on duty. They'd go to an abandoned lot that was had construction, or being prepared for construction, and they worked nights, so it was very late, off of the main highway, and do their business there and cover for each other.
So this took you a year to figure out what was going on, so this puts us in around last summer, I guess.
Yes, it was about last summer. It was the end of August when I actually called the Internal Affairs. I wanted to save my marriage, foolishly thinking that, and believing, because then I was told it was just this one random incident and it would never happen again. I knew the second I did it was the biggest mistake I ever made, and so on and so on. And I really wanted to try and save my marriage, so I didn't go to Internal Affairs, and I probably should have, but I wanted to try to save my marriage and didn't think turning him in would do anything to benefit that case or cause, so I didn't. But I did tell him that I would if he continued lying to me, that was the one contingency that I could not live with. All other problems I would learn to deal with, and we could get counseling for all of our issues and things like that, but I would not stay if he continued to lie, and that meant lying about anything. But I then found out another very big lie, which came from the wife of the other officer, because we had started talking by then. I had informed her. She had two children, and I felt that it was a safety issue that she should get tested for STDs. And I had debated for a month, really beat myself up over whether or not to contact her, but I finally felt that was important, that she should, for health-wise, be notified. And so we had kind of had a dialogue and shared information as we'd find out. And this was the last straw. I found out that it wasn't one time. It was multiple times. I found out that Scott was the instigator. My husband was the one that had suggested all of this in the first place, and that was it. I had had it. I had just couldn't take anymore, and at that point turned him in.
To internal affairs, you mean?
To internal affairs, yes.
So there had been no domestic abuse up until this point?
There had been one incident, but to be perfectly honest, I really don't even blame Scott for that, because I threw a drink at him first. He probably handled me a little rougher than necessary, but to be honest, I had started it, so at that point that was the only real domestic incident. And I didn't turn him in for that. I had discussed it with Internal Affairs, but didn't want him charged with it because I felt that I really instigated it.
So you go and you talk to the people at Internal Affairs, and he's charged with sexual misconduct and a few other things?
Well, he had been suspended already. He was suspended, what they called assigned to home, based on the admin charges, which were signing in and out false time, signing his in and out sheets. He had fallen asleep on duty one day while he was in the watchtower watching the recruits on the shooting range. He had fallen asleep, and one day he failed to show up or call in, and repeated late to start duty. Those were the four admin charges that he was already assigned a home for.
When did that happen?
That happened right around the 4th of July. It was right, we had just gone back from a vacation. And we had gotten stuck in an airport the night before. It ended up really, really late when we got home. He had to go to work the next day, probably on an hour or two of sleep at the most, and was exhausted. And that was the day he fell asleep on duty in the watchtower. And they immediately took his gun and badge and searched his locker. He was actually, they thought he was under the influence of drugs at the time.
So after you report him to Internal Affairs for this stuff, You're still living together?
Yes, we were. He had left. I used to ask him to leave quite often, and he'd end up coming back two or three days later with all kinds of promises of getting help, of I'll never lie again, I love you, I don't want to lose you, and I would agree to try and work things out again. So he had been gone for, I think, just overnight, and he was on his way back to the house, and I had called him up and said, I don't want you here, do not come here. I spoke to the partner's wife, And I know that that you still have not told me the whole truth, and that's it. I can't take any more, and I'm turning you in.
What was his reaction?
Well, he never thought I would do it. So he came here anyways, and I was actually on the phone with Internal Affairs. He still thought I was making it up. I was pretending to be on the phone with somebody. And when I hung up the phone, I said, well, they're coming out here. I had evidence. I had actual physical evidence. And they're coming to pick everything up and to interview me on tape. And they'll be here within an hour. And he still didn't believe it, so he stayed. And when they got here, they separated us. I wouldn't let him into my home, so he went in, he went to the backyard. And we had sat on the front porch and conducted the interview with me. I gave them the evidence that I had.
What was the physical evidence?
Well, I had a signed confession from Scott. And that had come about with by now, so I said, I don't think that you're telling me the truth. I don't think I know everything. And I'm not putting my name on a 30-year loan with somebody that's not being completely honest with me. And he swore that he had told me everything. I'd never find out anything else. What can I do to prove it? I said, put it in writing that I know everything, and it'll go in a safe. And if, in fact, you never lie to me again, then you have nothing to worry about. If you're not telling me the truth, I will use it. I will send it to your work. So it wasn't addressed to me. It was addressed to his captain. And it went in the safe, as I said, and it wasn't lie number one that I took it out. It was 9 months of lies before I actually said that's enough and did what I, in fact, had said I would do in the first place.
What happens to your husband next? Is it he's brought up on more charges?
At that point, I'm a lot out of the loop. Yes, there were additional. They investigated internal. I know that they did interview all four parties involved, meaning the two officers and the two other things that they were involved with. And I have nothing nice or no words to use for them because they're certainly not women. But they all four confirmed and my story, my allegations, and I guess the charges were added at that time. They were first Scott had fought to have them tried separately so that he'd have two separate boards, one for the administration and then one for that, on the advice of his attorney that the union provided. And they got it separated, so they were going to be looked at as two separate issues. Then I filed for divorce, and Scott perjured himself by writing a declaration stating that he should not have to pay his own bills because I am the reason he is not getting paid anymore, and that he's not at liberty to discuss it because the LAPD is still looking into it, but I should, in fact, pay him support because I'm the reason that he was not getting a paycheck. And obviously that's not the truth, but with it just being the administration charges that he was actually suspended for and not receiving pay anymore, well, that made it a lie. That was perjury. So he had to have the charges put back together. He had to have them tried again together in order to make that statement in family court true. And so then they did try him on all of them together, and he was found guilty on every single one of them. I do not know if the domestic abuse was included. It may be something additional because there's other pending things against him still that he's not seen a board of rights for yet.
When did the domestic abuse start?
There was really just one major incident, and it was right when he left. So it was the end of December, beginning of January, I believe.
And did you report what happened to a law enforcement agency?
Most definitely, immediately. I was beat up pretty good.
And who did you report it to?
The sheriff's department, because that's where we live.
That would be the L.A. County Sheriff's Department?
Yes.
What action did they take?
They came to my home. They took a Scott was not here. I had asked him to leave. He was at his mother's. So they took a report, issued a temporary restraining order, and took many, many photos. And at the time, it was two male officers or deputies. So they came back a couple hours later with a female officer to photograph my backside, because I was pretty scraped up and, well, bloody on parts below my waist. It went from the middle of my back all the way down to the middle of my leg, where I had just basically been thrown across the garage floor and scraped up pretty good and was pretty bloody. They needed a female officer to be able to photograph all the rest of the damage.
And what happened after this?
The LAPD contacted me almost immediately. Within like an hour, it was about 10 p.m., and a sergeant from the LAPD contacted me to see if I was okay. I talked to her at great length because I was pretty shook up and pretty upset and still foolishly wanting to try and save my marriage. And had just told her everything that we had been going through, and she asked if she could do it, gave me her phone number, said to call anytime, and that, you know, I would probably be contacted in the next couple of days to be interviewed for it, which I was. And so the LAPD, the next day, the same detective from Internal Affairs that I had talked to before, came out to interview me about the domestic abuse that had occurred the day before. During this interview, he asked to see where this happened, which was in the garage, like I said. I took him out to the garage, and he noticed about 12, 13 ammunition cans, like the Army would have, and said, "What is all this?" And I said, "Scott's ammunition," which was about 1,100 pounds, not authorized. So that's another charge that he would face that he still hasn't been brought up on yet, but that they have investigated, and it just hasn't gone to a Board of Rights yet. I was told that if he gets fired for these things, then it won't even become an issue unless they decide to file criminal charges. But if he does get off, if they were to give him his job back for all these things, he would then face that as well.
Do you want him charged with criminal charges?
Absolutely. He is a criminal and thinks that he's above the law, and mostly for that purpose, because he so much thinks that he has the right to do these things just because he carries that badge. That he's somehow better than the average citizen and deserves some kind of special treatment.
Have you talked to a district attorney or a prosecutor at all at any time?
The sheriff's department assigned it to a sergeant, a detective. She asked me to come in to be interviewed again. I had just recently started my own business, which is from my home, and Scott's not assisting, hasn't assisted with bills in any way, and I didn't trust him to be financially responsible. And so I asked her, I said it just wasn't convenient for me to come there, but that if she wanted to come here or do it over the telephone, I'd be more than happy and more than willing to cooperate, and that did not please her at all. Eventually, she did ask me some questions over the phone, but it was about 2 weeks later, and there were little details. She had already seen Scott and interviewed him, and the things that there were a couple of things she was saying I didn't recall at all, and so she really made me feel like I was lying, and said at one point, you know, how could you not remember this? And you're, you know, And really, I felt like I was the bad guy. And I don't think, because I didn't recall one or two details, or at least I didn't recall them the way he had explained them, that I was, in fact, the one lying, regardless of the fact she had two, you know, rolls of film there to show the damage. They're cops, and they protect each other, and they don't ever want to have to bust one of their own. So I don't know that it ever went to the district attorney. I was certainly never contacted by anybody beyond that interview.
So as far as you know, nothing has happened with your allegation of domestic abuse since you spoke on that day with that detective?
Right. Not as far as, yes, not as far as the sheriffs are concerned. The LAPD now was out of their jurisdiction, so I don't know that they can criminally charge him, but he was most definitely been brought up on charges within the department for it.
Okay.
I don't know that if that was included in the Board of Rights with the other things he was just found guilty for, or if it's something that they're doing separately. They don't give me that information.
So after all is said and done, after all this time, after all of being found guilty on these internal charges and allegation of domestic assault and other problems throughout his career, he is still technically employed by the LAPD.
That is correct. And in fact, I was told that the partner, although the partner now has only been accused and also found guilty, by the way, found guilty of sexual misconduct, that the partner was cooperative when investigated and more forthcoming than my husband, and therefore chances are very good that that officer will in fact get to keep his job. And to me that says it's okay if, you know, they could have killed us. To me, I don't understand why the fact that they put our lives at risk, why that's not some sort of attempted murder. I mean, just because we are the spouse, it's okay to kill your spouse if it's by AIDS, as long as it's not by your fist. And I don't understand that at all, but he will probably get his job back. Scott, the only reason he's not going to is not for that, but the domestic abuse is something they do take pretty serious.
Have you had any contact with any LAPD officials or city officials outside of the police department about your husband?
Not outside of the police department, no. No, I've called repeatedly trying to get information as to what's going on, and I'm not informed, not that they don't open their arms warmly to me at all. I was actually yelled at by one of the chiefs of the adjutant's office last week for attempting to go to the media. And I said, well, if you guys would just make a decision, I mean, Scott's using you as his stall tactic for our divorce case, and I need some help here. I can't pay the bills. I'm paying my bills, his bills, all community bills, and I need some help. So I need you to make a decision so he can't use that in family court anymore. And if you're not going to make, I mean, I didn't go to the media for, it's been 2 years. It's a very humiliating topic, and I would have preferred it not to get out to the media, but if that's the only way to get the LAPD to do anything, to make a darn decision, I didn't see any other choice, which is really why I first started contacting the media. I hope that the other people out there, I'm not sure that this will be as helpful, that they don't feel, that they do feel that they can report it and say something, and even if they have to fight to be heard, that they do in fact have the right, and nobody deserves to be treated this way. And I hope that they will get the help that they deserve.
Thanks to Michelle Druyan for taking the time to speak with me. We'll be sure to keep you up to date with any new developments in that story.
the day it occurred, Global TV contacted me.
Yes.
And I looked into it. My understanding is that they licensed liquor license premise check was being conducted. One thing led to another, and it is alleged that that the owner of the bar threw something, and which caused police to react and effect an arrest. And during the arrest, there was a struggle in which he's alleging that he was assaulted. He was taken to the station, in which he was charged and released. I know Chief Blair was made aware of it the day that it occurred and commented while he was walking the parade. I wasn't with him, so I don't know exactly what he said. So I don't know what he commented to Global at the time, but he was very well made aware of it. He was aware of the checks that were going on in that time. It was things were being done as a precaution and a safety measure with thousands of people brought into that area. Overcrowding of the bars, that's when problems happen and people's safety become at risk. So it was a measure that was planned to ensure the safety of the visitors and all the influx of people we had to that area. We have a list of the premises that were checked and how many charges laid. I don't think anything, and I don't believe any other ones had cause to be closed, no.
Toronto's annual Gay Pride celebrations draw tens of thousands of tourists to the bars and nightclubs in the city's gay village each year. After years of uncomfortable relations between the gay community and the Toronto police during the tenure of the previous chief of police, the new chief, Bill Blair, made an attempt to smooth things over this year by hosting a Pride Week reception and by becoming the first police chief in Toronto history to march in the Pride Parade. Virtually all of the media coverage of this year's Pride Parade included a mention of Blair's presence. On June 25th, around 12 hours before the parade, during the busiest hours at any of the handful of licensed establishments in the gay village, Toronto police officers and alcohol inspectors entered the Babylon Martini and Musique Boutique on Church Street and ordered the club closed due to overcrowding. After the customers left, there was a confrontation between the bar's owner, Amir Ebrahimnia, and some of the police officers. Both sides agree that a physical confrontation occurred after Ebrahimnia threw an empty martini shaker at a wall, but after that point, the stories differ. Ebrahimnia claims he was beaten by the police for 15 minutes. He says that officers terrorized his elderly parents, delayed medical assistance required by his mother, used racial slurs repeatedly, and damaged his nightclub substantially. Ebrahimnia was taken to 51 Division, where he was charged with obstructing a peace officer, assault with a weapon, and resisting a peace officer. The Toronto police say that they were conducting a liquor license inspection when they arrived at the club. When pressed, they admitted that on one of the busiest nights of the year for bars in the village, no other establishments were closed by 51 Division officers. The alleged repeated use of racial slurs and the closing of the bar under similar circumstances during last year's Pride celebrations have led to speculation that the bar may have been targeted because of the Iranian heritage of the proprietors. Ebrahimnia and the Toronto police agree that this is not likely. On the morning of the 26th, before he had even sought medical treatment, Ebrahimnia says that a news crew from Global Television, a large, privately owned Canadian network, spoke with him and shot footage of the damage to his establishment. A spokesperson for the Toronto Police said that Chief Bill Blair commented on the allegations to a Global reporter while he was marching in the parade. A news story that was to be aired the evening of June 26th was never broadcast. In fact, not a word of this story has appeared in the mainstream press as we prepare to go to air more than a week and a half after the alleged beating occurred. I spoke with Amir Ebrahimnia at his home a few days ago.
Like, the inspectors, they come in around after 11:30. They always come in after 11:30.
But these people that came in on Saturday were not inspectors.
Yeah, they were.
They were inspectors or cops? Or are the inspectors cops?
See, that's a thing. Before, 9 years out of the 11 years, before like the past couple of years we've been having issues with them, it would be separate, right? You would get the inspectors coming in, doing a little checkup. Usually they were always pretty decent. They were pretty cool. They were decent before. They would check up on you, make sure everything's okay. The police would do the same thing. When 52 Division was in power, they would come in, They would come in even before Pride. They would introduce themselves. It was a very much a community feeling, right? During Pride, they would walk in, and they would just walk around, make sure everything's okay. They would check up on us. Are you guys doing okay? Any problems at all? If you need our help, anything like that, right? That's the way we used to get treated on Church Street. Okay, that's what I've been used to. I'm accustomed to that kind of treatment. So for the past 2 years, I've had to voice my concerns over the new treatment that we're getting.
Okay, so what happened last year?
Last year, same thing. We got charged with overcrowding. When I went to meet the inspector downstairs, because they wanted to speak to me and I was upstairs, I went down there. There was maybe two or three liquor inspectors accompanied by four or five police officers undercover. Right. So same deal as this year. The only difference between this year and last year was last year I didn't argue. Well, this year I had nothing else to lose. This year, it's when I saw them, you know, what else is there to lose? Right? They're charging me with it. I might as well voice my concerns.
So the charge is overcrowding. They come in, they tell you you're overcrowded.
They come in, they tell you you're overcrowded. And they want to close the doors. They want everybody out.
So you complied.
Mm-hmm. I was up on the third floor. I was behind a bar. I was helping a bartender. And I got called downstairs by one of the staff members saying there's a confrontation downstairs. I didn't know what was wrong. They didn't say it was an inspector or anything. They just said there's a confrontation. Like, to me, again, that just means there's a confrontation downstairs. I should go down, yeah. So I dropped what I was doing. I went downstairs to the first floor. As I walked into the first floor, I was walking towards a bar, and I could see what I assumed to be undercover police officers or inspectors. Again, like, no badge was shown, but I did recognize a couple of people in there, so I knew who they were.
And they're big guys.
They stick out like a sore thumb,
yeah.
Like gay parade. So when I was walking towards them, I noticed that my father, there was maybe five inspectors that were kind of like surrounding around my father, and he looked mad, and I know it takes a lot to get him mad, so I knew there was a problem. I noticed there were kind of like he was talking to them, and they were pretending like they didn't understand what he was talking about because he has an accent,
okay.
Right? It's just like I knew what I was walking into. I could hear it, I could see it, but again, like, it's inspectors, so,
yeah.
Right, overcrowding, it can be dangerous, right, there's a lot of issues with that, but again, you have to look at the circumstances that you're creating as a city of Toronto for an event such as this, right, again, getting back to one of the points that I made in the statement of, you know, as a city of Toronto, you're inviting over 1 million people. You're getting 1 million people for a gay party on a gay street that's four blocks with
right.
about 20 or less licensed establishments that cannot handle a big crowd. The government's always turned a blind eye. And all of a sudden, it seems like everybody wants to make money on Pride, be it the city, be it the liquor inspectors, be it giving out fines, doing whatever. It's just like going after every single little buck, right? That's what it feels like. So, I mean, there's no other reason for it. Before, they used to turn a blind eye. It wasn't a big deal. Nobody was getting hurt, right? And it's funny because when they came into my place, and the third floor was very busy, we were extremely overcrowded. But you see, me as a bar owner, I've been there for 11 years, and I know for a fact that busyness is only going to last 5 minutes, okay? It's just not going to last any longer than that. And the funny thing is, from the time that I left the third floor to run downstairs to the time that I came back upstairs to clear the room was at capacity. And that's the thing. Like, they come in, they stick around for that, they know exactly when to come in, when to grab you. They're waiting outside for the place to get packed anyways, right? It's a whole systematic thing that they do. It's not just, you know, they're going to walk into an establishment and see if it's busy or not. It's their job to know that this is the case. It's their job to know if they're there 15 minutes later, it's not going to be as busy, right? They're going to take advantage of that. And I don't see the justice in that, right? Especially when things get so out of hand where they feel like it's okay to do a lot of things that... I went down there. I joined in the argument. They were telling me I need to shut down right now. I was overcrowded. So I started telling them, I started telling them why it was that we were overcrowded, exactly the story I just told you, explaining to them. They're not there, it's not their job to hear that. Okay, they'll admit to that. Oh, it's not our job to hear that. That's not our problem, that's your problem. Last year where I got fined, I had to go to court for it a couple of months ago, and I took my lawyer, we went to court, and I wanted to speak at a liquor hearing.
Did you get to speak?
No, of course not. It doesn't happen. It doesn't work like that. You see, for me, being a simpleton that I am, I thought that I get to go to court, and just like you see in the movies, I get to tell my side of the story. Make an argument. Not just an argument, just tell them, try to explain to them. Because somebody has to hear the problem if they're going to fix it, right? I told my lawyer, I said, you know what, I want to go in there, I want to say this. And he said to me, he said, that's definitely not a good idea if I wanted to keep my liquor license, right? Because these are not the kind of people that you talk to, right? You send your lawyer in, he makes a deal, you go in for the show, yeah, sign the paper, do what you need to do, and that's that. You don't get to talk to them, they don't want to talk to you, they don't want to hear from you. You know, if you say, thank you, sir, they might revoke you, right? See, that's, again, other things that are wrong with the system, right there. Why should, a handful of people have so much control over something, and they're not even doing their job properly? Since I didn't get to speak in court, I figured, well, this time around, they told me to clear the bar, close down, shut down, so right there, I know I'm screwed. This time, I'm not going to get to survive, right? I know that they're closing me down now, that this is it. I'm not going to have the power to get back up again. You see, initially, from my charges last year, I got convicted to close down. I was suspended for 1 week, which I get to pick which week that is, right? So strategically, I figured if I'm going to close for 1 week, that's going to hurt me, right? That's going to hurt me hard. So what I decided to do is I picked the week right after Pride, where I could earn good money on Pride, or try to earn good money on Pride, so I can afford to close for a week, so I can reopen again and struggle and stay alive anyways. So that was the plan. Struggle was still a part of the plan, right? So once this happened, I knew. I was like, well, you know what? That's it. I might as well talk. I said, listen, they told me, they said they didn't want to hear my concerns. I'm like, no, I'm going to tell you my concerns, and you're going to listen to them, because somebody has to listen to them. And if I go to a liquor court, and if they're not going to listen to it, then you know what? You're the only people I get to see. You get to listen to it. And as I was saying this to them, music was shut, lights were on, and the room was packed with people. Okay, so I'm telling them exactly how I feel. I'm telling them about all the problems that's with the system, and what they're doing wrong, and everything I see wrong with the situation. I'm saying this to the cops, but there's a whole entire room listening to me. And in that room, there's politicians, there's lawyers, there's all these different people. I'm just finding out now exactly who was in that room. Again, they were getting really agitated because they didn't like to have so many people in a room listening to this argument, making them look bad. But my intention wasn't to embarrass them. My intention was just, you know what, I just needed to get it out. It wasn't arguing with them. It was just me stating my case. While that was going on, it was unbelievable, because one of the officers, but I'm assuming it was an officer because I couldn't see an inspector doing what she did. She started shoving me and pushing me. And again, it's in front of like a full room. And I'm saying to her, I said, listen, don't touch me. As far as I know, that's illegal. So I'm telling her, I said, you know what? Don't touch me. Don't push me. Don't touch me. And again, in front of people, she's saying, what are you going to do about it? Right?
So they were clearly...
They were clearly above the law.
Confrontational.
Confrontational and above the law. They didn't care who was in the room. They didn't care if it was witnesses or not. They didn't care about any of that. Right? See, that's the scary part. And again, I didn't realize how bad things were going to get until later, right? So while I was saying all this, that really pissed them off. After everybody left, I even had one of the officers, he just like laid into me, like shouldered me, while another one called me an idiot. And he said, you're an idiot. You just made a total fool out of yourself. So I get called an idiot. I turned around and I called him a moron. And again, it was like a total like back and forth, like war of words and swearing, and that's it. But it was vocal. I got out of line. I said a lot of things, but it was just in retaliation to whatever I was hearing coming out of them, right? A lot of things that they did wrong and said wrong. You know, it's a... I was angry, but it was just words. And I didn't think that they would react to words like that, right? It wasn't threatening words. They started shoving me, pushing me, and again, that's when my mom started freaking out, because she saw them touch me, and she was on a second floor, and she just, like, started freaking out, right? She just, like, lost it. Again, she didn't attack them or anything, but she was yelling at them to stop it. At this point, like, she kind of fell to the ground. She wasn't feeling well. We thought she was having a stroke. She was having, like, a mild something. So when I saw that happen, I backed off a little bit. And I just backed off and I said, listen, everybody just calm down, right? This is getting out of control. This is getting out of hand.
So you could see right? it escalating.
I could see this escalating, and it didn't need to, because they've already done their job. Everybody's out of the bar, right? The crowd's been shown out. There's nobody else there. It's just the staff and ourselves. You see, before what they were trying to do, I got the feeling they were trying to intimidate me. They wanted me to do something. They were waiting for me, not just waiting for me, they wanted me to do something. They were provoking me. They were completely provoking me, right? From when all else failed, they started pushing, right? When all else failed, they started pushing. When the name callings failed, they started pushing. When I was talking to them, sometimes I would talk like this, and they was like, put your hands down, please, sir. I wasn't allowed to raise my hand when I was talking, right? It wasn't a fist. My dad, he's Iranian, and he talks with his hands. And meanwhile, he's not understanding why there's somebody telling him to put down his hands, right? Because he's not threatening anyone.
Right.
And his English isn't good enough to know that. But then they start grabbing him and start, you know, harassing him. At one point on the second floor, when I was talking to them, and my mom was going down, and my dad came running upstairs, and it became such a... It was becoming like a brawl. It was turning into a brawl between myself, my dad, my mom on the floor, and 5-6 cops, and then a couple of staff members coming up, right? But it's turning into like a pushing, screaming, and that's when I told them, I said, everybody just back off. Everybody just back off. I pushed my dad aside, I took my mom, sat her down on the couch, and I went back to the cops, and still, they weren't backing off. They kept on coming back towards us. They wanted us out of the bar. They wanted us to leave the establishment. My mom needs medical attention. My dad, he needs a glass of water, because I don't know if he's having a heart attack or what, but he doesn't look too well, right? I'm trying to tell these guys to back off. Finally, I start swearing at them. I'm like, listen, you've done your fucking jobs. Why are you still here? They wouldn't leave. They're like, nope, you have to clear the premises. You have to clear the premises. I'm like, why? It's my bar. Why do I have to clear the premises? Everybody's left, right? What else is there to do? I took my mom downstairs from the second floor to first floor, laid her down on the couch, and she didn't look well. I looked at two of the officers standing by the door, and there was a female officer. I looked directly at her and I said, can you please get us some help? Dial 911. Right, my mom needs medical attention. She looked at me for like a split second. She's like, you know, you have a phone. You dial 911. Right, so that was a response. I was like, fine, you know what, I got no time to even think about this right now.
Right.
I go running to the first floor behind a bar, pick up a telephone, I dialed 911, and regular questions, ambulance, fire, police. I'm like, I need an ambulance at 553 Church Street. What's wrong, sir? I told her what's wrong. I said, you know, 60-year-old woman, she's down, we think it's a stroke, she's having trouble breathing. And I gave the address, and as I was doing that, the police officers, they started moving back in again, right? So picture this, my mom is on, I'm standing behind a bar, my mom would be at my 11 o'clock on the couch on the other side of the room. The door that they're coming from is like 12:30, right? And there's a wall on my 4 o'clock, right? So as I'm on the phone, I see them walking in to grab my mom and push her out.
Oh.
Okay, that's when I freaked out. I started yelling at the police officers. You know what? Just get the fuck out. You've done enough. You've done your job. I'm on the phone with 911 at the time, right? And I whipped the martini shaker at the wall at my 4 o'clock.
And was there anyone near there?
No. As soon as I whipped the martini shaker, that was the moment that they were waiting for all along. Now, that's when I was still on the phone with 911. I told them, I said, you know what, just get the fuck out, blah, blah, blah. You know, I was yelling at them. I threw the martini shaker at the wall. That's when they ran over, and by that point, I dropped the phone, and I was pummeled. Like, they beat me for about 15 minutes. Like, I lost track of time. My staff members, they were all there, and they came to help me out. Well, they tried to say something or do something, but the police just pushed them aside. Even, I had a couple of my staff members say, listen, we're witnessing this. We're witnessing this. And they just said, you know what, get the fuck out. Kick them all out. And they continued. Now, when they attacked me, see, I thought at first that what's happening is they're just going to jump on top of me. They're just going to jump on top of me and handcuff me. That's what I was expecting. I went down, I put my hand behind me, but that's not what happened. I got punched in the head several times. I had a gentleman who kept on stomping my face while another guy grabbed me by the hair and started smashing my head on the ground, right? And I could hear them, like, saying, oh, you had to be a fucking smartass, didn't you? Right? And several times I heard them say, stop resisting arrest, stop resisting arrest. And I kept on screaming. I said, I'm not resisting arrest. You know, my hands behind me.
Was the phone right? off the hook?
I don't know. I dropped the phone. I don't know if they hung it up or... You see, that's another thing that we really need to find out. We need to get those phone records from 911. So, yeah, after that, they put me in a cop car, and they took me down to 51 Division. From what I thought, I couldn't tell, because there was so many people on top of me, I just couldn't tell. Like, I was just in a fetal position. They stretched me out of the fetal position. They just continued to beat me. But from what I thought, originally what I thought was there was 8. Because I just assumed everybody there was just involved. I talked to a couple of my witnesses yesterday, and they said there was 4, maybe 5. So it's less than what I originally thought. They take me to 51 Division, and I get strip searched. They made me take off all my clothes, turn my clothes inside out, lift my scrotum and my leg. And again, like, it's funny just telling the story, and I'm supposed to be a businessman, but to be a businessman, to be a taxpayer, tax collector for the government, and to be strip searched, right? That's just the icing on the cake, right? It's like you go through all that, complete full humiliation. You know, they put me in a cell or a room, like an interrogation room of some sort, and about, I don't know how long later, it seemed like forever, I'm guessing like an hour and a half, 2 hours later, somebody showed up. It was actually one of the officers that beat me up that showed up. And he told me what I was being charged with, if I understood. I said, yes, I do. And they made me sign a couple of pieces of paper, like 4 or 5 pieces of paper. At no time was I given the opportunity to make a phone call. As a matter of fact, when he... afterwards. No, it wasn't when he came in to make me sign a piece of paper. He made me sign a piece of paper that stated that I understood and I was going to show up for court and fingerprinting. And then I was to be released. And maybe half an hour, 45 minutes later, they released me. They led me up to the front room where I was to get my my stuff, my belt, and my money, my belonging. And that's where they put another piece of paper in front of me to sign that I've received everything. And on top of that, there was another piece of paper saying that I have refused my phone call privileges, which I read it and I didn't sign it. I was like, I didn't refuse. I've never got my phone call. You know, you never gave me my phone call. I didn't refuse it. They released me. I walked home. I went home. I went to my mom's and just spent the night with her. That's when I got their side of the story on the other things that happened. So my mom was taken to the Pride headquarters, where the beer store is. Mm-hmm. They set up the Pride headquarters there, and she was given medical attention there until the ambulance came, I think. And she kept on asking, like, you know, where I was. They wouldn't tell her. right? She asked to use her telephone. They wouldn't let her use it. They just kept on ignoring her. Finally, actually, I think it was a paramedic that gave her his telephone to use, right? Again, like, the cops were just nasty. You know, everything you would expect a nightmare to be, you know? Finally, when I saw my parents, like, yeah, they were just, like, in shock. Like, we were all very much in shock for, like, the next 4 days after that. I walked back home that night after 51 Division, and I could walk no problem. Like, I think I was just, like, I was shaking from anger, but I didn't feel any pain.
Right.
Walked home, no problem. Couldn't sleep that night. Severe, like, just nausea, and I kept on and vomiting, sweats, chills. Like, it was a really weird feeling. It was almost as if I had a flu or something. And by next day, I was just, like, swollen up, like, all over. So, on a Sunday, things just got worse and worse and worse. So, from the beating, I was having problems breathing. So, I called 911 at 12 o'clock. So, it was noon. It was noon on Sunday on Gay Pride. And they asked me if I wanted a police or fire or ambulance. I said I wanted an ambulance. They put me through the ambulance, and they asked me what was wrong. I told them what was wrong. Exactly. I'm going through the same process as I did the night before to 911 again. Except this time around, they take the order, and I wait, and I wait. I was lying right here, and I kept on going in and out of consciousness. And I got a phone call at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the afternoon from 51 Division. And it was somebody calling me from 51 Division saying that... What did she say? She was like, yeah, you put in a request for an ambulance. We just want you to know, you know, it's no problem. You're going to get your ambulance, but it has to be accompanied by an officer. And she's like, well, it has to be a 51 Division officer. It made me really angry. And I told her, I said, listen, I don't want you people to call me. I don't want you people coming anywhere near me. Right? I want an ambulance. And they said, oh, I understand, but it has to be accompanied by a 51 Division officer. And she kept on saying that. I said, well, are you refusing me medical treatment? She's like, oh, no, sir, I'm not saying that, sir. But it has to be accompanied by a 51 Division officer, right? And I kept on telling her, I said, look, I don't, you know, this is exactly what the problem is. Like, I don't want you people near me. This goes on for, like, a good 5 minutes of me begging for an ambulance.
And you've already been waiting for...
an hour and a half, 2 hours. And... she was like, well, what do you want us to do? I was like, oh, forget it. Right. So I hung up on her. I called back 911. I called back 911, and I asked to talk to the ambulance again. I told them, I said, again, I didn't say what was wrong. I just said, listen, I need an ambulance at this address. Right. I figured I'd just put in a fresh order. She knew exactly what was up. The operator typed it in. Oh, yes, ma'am. Okay, yeah, well, it has to be accompanied by a 51 Division officer. So now I get 911 telling me the same thing. I start freaking out on her, and she passed it off to the supervisor. Supervisor comes on, and he says that, you know, it's because of the nature of my injuries, it would require a police officer to be there. So again, I told him, I said, look, I do not have a problem with you sending a police officer. I just don't want a 51 Division police officer to accompany you to my house. They didn't go for it. I don't remember if I hung up and if I called back again in like half an hour or how many times I called. I called a few times back to 911. Finally, I agreed. And then 7:30 p.m., I got an ambulance. They took me to St. Michael's and had the doctors take me in. They took x-rays, they checked out the bruises, nothing broken, and yeah, just checked me out. He said you're probably gonna go, the pain's probably gonna get a lot worse in the next 48 hours, so prescribed some medication. I got, what do we got, Tylenol 3s and apomeprazole, but yeah, but he was right. I came home and it just got worse and worse, the pains. Originally, the doctor said that there's going to be an officer coming in to do an investigation, right? Because they had to call in the police. for a case like this. So I said, fine, no problem. We wait around for a little bit. And then they were like, well, apparently the forensics officer, he's not available. It's going to take him a little while. So we said we're just going to go to the police station ourselves. So we agreed to go down to 52 Division. So we went into 52 Division, and they were expecting us there because they talked to the hospital already. And they were really nice to us. Yeah, I waited for a forensics officer to come down. And he took pictures of the wounds. He measured them. And the forensics officer, he was a really nice gentleman. Like he seemed pretty disgusted by what I told him. He did say he's been a police officer for 33 years, and it made him really sick to his stomach to see shit like this. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty good indication. Plus, the people that were there, that were just like serving us, they were pretty understanding. They even there was something exchanged between us, almost like a knowledge that they know how bad 51 Division is.
Yeah,
I think within the police force, within the community, everybody knows how bad 51 Division is.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, it's something that's becoming, like, very much common knowledge. Like, everybody's got some kind of a terror story nowadays about it, right? And that's the kind of the feeling that I got from them, you know? Like, he even kind of, like, hinted towards, like, how, you know, it wasn't like that when 52 Division was there. You know, we almost like reminisced about the old days when 52 Division was over on Church Street and things were a lot better. One thing I really, really, really got to say, I mean, I'm not going to get a chance to open up my bar again, but I really got to say this, that it was 11 years of, I took a lot of honor in it, you know what I mean? A lot of pride in it, and a lot of our customers, we've had very, very, like, they've been our family. Like, we get regulars from all over the states, all over the world. And it's really, really, really nice. It's comforting. And half the time, we may not know what they do for a living, but I can tell you right now, like, from some of the replies we've been getting from the emails, I'm just beginning to learn exactly who our customers were. But they have been a family. And even now, they've really come together. Like, when I send out that email to my customer list, to my friends list, you know, it caught on.
Thanks to Amir Ebrahimnia for spending that time with me. A few things to tell you about quickly before we go. A 39-year-old man in Beamsville, Ontario, died last Friday after he was shocked with a taser by Niagara Regional Police officers. The Niagara Department had only been using tasers for 1 week. The death comes just weeks after Ontario's first coroner's inquest into a taser-related death recommended that all frontline officers in the province should be armed with tasers and trained in their use. A 41-year-old man died after being shot with a taser by RCMP officers in Surrey, British Columbia, last Thursday. He became the fourth person to die in British Columbia after being shocked with a taser. Tasers, which deliver a 50,000-volt shock, which incapacitates the victim, are manufactured by Arizona-based Taser International. The devices can be used either by direct application or can deliver a shock through two 21-foot wires, which are launched from the weapon and are attached to harpoon-like probes, which pierce the skin of the target. Some critics have questioned the research upon which the company bases its claims about the safety of its products. Concerns about the safety of the devices have been raised by the U.S. Justice Department, the Arizona State Attorney General, ACLU, animal rights activists, doctors, scientists, coroners, human rights activists, and others. A report released last November by Amnesty International linked tasers to 74 deaths since 2001. Since the release of that report, the number of deaths linked to tasers has nearly doubled. Taser International and many police departments continue to insist that the devices save lives. Other than the killings we just told you about, police also killed people this week in North Pole, Alaska, Fresno, California, Emeryville, California, Chester, Pennsylvania, Chicago, Illinois, Houston, Texas, and two people were killed in separate incidents by police in Phoenix, Arizona. That's all for Bad Cop No Donut this week. Tune into this station for our usual program next week. If you've got something to tell us about the police where you live, or if you have any comments about this program, please feel free to send an email to ron@ckln.fm. And thanks once again to Michelle Druyan and Amir Ebrahimnia for speaking to me this week. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich.
Watch out, I am gonna end up back inside. If there's a cop, it opens a screw. He wants to mess up for looking at the prisoners. It's just a walk for found him out of every museum. I don't end up like my dad, and I won't end up in a screw. For 20 days, thought I'd pray, I've got to pay. It wasn't me, it wasn't me, and I've been dreamed. I didn't really come, it wasn't my fault. It came at me with a broken bottle. Tried to warn him, I had no name, and now he's dead. I won't end up like my dad, and I won't end up being a scream. Sound of a couple of children to play. You better watch out, or you're gonna end up back inside. If there's a cop, it opens a screw. You want to be soft, you're looking at the prisoners. Just to walk from the bottom of the mud, I'm having a I won't end up like my dad.